Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harris. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got to know.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Welcome to the Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. I am Paul Harris, sitting here at Table 2, our home for the final table every week. Dennis Phillips is literally minutes away, having just gotten off a plane a half hour ago from a two-week road trip that included the LAPT in Argentina and the EPT in London. He's going to be here in just a few minutes, joining me live here on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. And, of course, on our podcasts available on thechipleader.com. While he was on the road internationally, I was doing a little poker traveling myself. Took a trip down to Florida. We've talked quite a bit, including with some pros on this show who have made a move down to Florida ever since the rules changed down there on July 1st. There used to be a $100 buy-in cap, and before that there were even more restrictive rules about buy-ins and pot sizes. At one point, no poker pot could get over $10. Well, when that changed on July 1st, a lot of people who play in cash games in particular thought, well, this is going to be a pretty lucrative area to hit fairly early on, because you're going to have a lot of people down there who aren't experienced in playing in deep stack cash games, and the casinos down there have kind of jumped on this bandwagon and run with it. So I went down for a long weekend to the area around Fort Lauderdale and Pompano Beach and West Palm Beach. There are probably about a dozen different poker rooms throughout that part of Florida. I was there and hit three of them. One of them, and I would have to say the nicest looking one, was the Isle at Pompano Beach, which is a harness racing track. Whose season wasn't started up yet. It is getting started, as a matter of fact, this weekend in Pompano Beach. And it's not a full-fledged casino. It's very interesting to go down there, and these racetracks do have slot machines, and they do have big poker rooms, but they don't have the other table games. You won't see blackjack, you won't see three-card poker, Caribbean stud, roulette, craps, all of those other table games that make up the bulk of the non-slot action in a casino. But the Isle has a huge poker room and beautifully built, wood and leather and lots of action. In the three sessions that I played there over the course of the weekend, there was lots of action at every level, all the way up to the 5-10 game that I played in. I also played in a place in Palm Beach called the Palm Beach Kennel Club, which is a dog racing track where the greyhounds run afternoons and evenings. And it is not as beautiful a facility, but the action I found there was even better. They have lots and lots of tables there. I would say in each of these places, they've got about three dozen or more tables, and they run big tournaments as well. In fact, the day that I was at the Palm Beach Kennel Club, they were running a tournament that probably had about 250 people in it. And one of the things that they do with these tournaments is they kind of paper the room, walking around to the cash games, going up to a table and telling people, hey, you know what, in the next hand, we're going to give the winner of the next hand a seat to Sunday's tournament or Monday's tournament, whatever it may be. In fact, in one of those cash games that I played in, they told me that the tournament that had started at noon that day, half of the people who were in it had gotten papered in, which means, of course, that the casino is making up the buy-in for all of those people. They're not making it up out of their own pockets. What they're doing is taking it out of bad beat money and running a dollar off of every hand. But they're buying a lot of people into these things, and so they end up with big tournaments there and big cash games as well. I'll tell you more in a second, but look who just sat down, Dennis Phillips.
I actually showed up.
You raced right over here from Lambert Airport, didn't you?
Yes, I absolutely did. Sorry about my appearance, but I really don't care.
you look fine, and I know you're a little bit jet-lagged. I was just talking about my trip to Florida and playing in the games down there. So I played at the Isle of Pompano Beach, and I played at the Palm Beach Kennel Club, which is interesting because you have to pay $1 to get in because it's the same entrance that you would pay for the grandstand for the dog track. It's in the same area, and it's very odd sometimes when you're sitting in the middle of a big hand and trying to make a big decision, and all of a sudden something goes rushing by the outside of the window, and it's the greyhounds who run about every 10 minutes, and they go fairly quickly. So that's an interesting distraction. The third place I played was the Hard Rock, which is a Seminole casino in Hollywood, Florida, which is different from the other two in that it being on an Indian reservation, they have a full-fledged casino. It's a huge, huge place with the poker room actually in a different part, actually in a different building from the main part of the casino. Of the three places that I visited, this is the one that I liked the least, only because of the way it was set up in a huge open-air two-story room with lots of music playing a little bit too loud, and the ambient sound in the room I found very, very distracting as I was going through it. But I had a great time at the Palm Beach Kennel Club and at the Isle Pompano Beach. One of the things that I don't like as a cash game player who sits down in 5-10 games is that they had a $1 bad beat they were taking out of every hand. Usually that's something that works at lower limit games. Here in St. Louis, once you get to 5-10 and higher,
right,
the bad beat doesn't exist because we as the players have told management we don't want that in there.
That's exactly right. And management here, they've done a very good job. Basically, they'll bend to whatever the majority of the players want, and we decided we didn't want that, so they stopped pulling the rake, so that's very good.
Yeah, they've got a in Florida, at these places, they've got a $5 rake as opposed to a $4, which we have here, plus the $1 bad beat. The reason I'm opposed to the bad beat, although some of the players down there disagreed with me on it, you know, they all see 140,000 or 150,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, you know, it's that lottery or slot machine mentality. I want to hit that. I want to get a piece of that. But when you're playing at a 5-10 or higher game, the chances of a bad beat hand, I can't remember the last time I saw quad tens beat in a 5-10 or higher game. And that's what you have to have at one of the places I played. Quad tens have to be beat by quads or a straight flush. What's the last time you saw that in a big money game?
That's ludicrous. Yeah, I mean, it never gets there. They're too good of quality players, and the cost is too much.
Yeah,
they're not going to be drawing out to this. I mean, unless you flop set over set and then turn and river the other two, that's about the only way it's going to happen.
Exactly, and it's much more likely to happen at a 3-6 limit game.
Absolutely.
You know, where you have to call an extra $6 to see.
Correct.
In a 5-10 game, you might have to call another $600 or maybe another $6,000 to see that river card.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are going to throw it away.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I honestly can't remember the last time I saw a beat that big in any of the games that I play. So I didn't like that. But I did like the way that they ran some of these rooms down there. The Palm Beach Kennel Club had two different 5-10 games going on, one with a $2,500 cap on your buy-in, the other with a $300 cap.
You
could buy in for $100 to $300. The reason they kept it is because before July 1st, they had the $100 max, and a lot of people like to go in there and look at it as essentially a one-hand deal.
Yep.
You know, they'd wait to get a big hand and then try to get in there and double up or triple up against the other players. So they have that. There was also a 10-25 game going the day I was there. And they love their action down there. Dennis, the pre-flop raises in these 5-10 games in all of the casinos I played, around here, $30, $40, maybe $50. There, they were opening for $70, $80, $100.
And again, I played when they had the 100 cap, and that was the standard down there when they had the 100 cap, when these guys were coming in and they were shoving when they got a decent hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may be a carryover from that.
Maybe.
I did talk to a couple of the pros that are playing down there, and it's just an awesome game. They are loving it right now.
Yeah.
Now, that's obviously going to change, and they're probably going to get away from it, become more of the standard status quo like we have in all the other casinos. But for right now, it's a lot of action, a lot of people that aren't used to playing at these levels, and a lot of pros that are really smiling.
There are a lot of pros. I don't mean big-name pros who you'll see on TV poker, but a lot of guys who grind it out and play poker for a living and make a good living that way, who go from place to place. One of the guys that I played with had moved to Biloxi, Mississippi.
a couple of years ago to play at the Beau Rivage, Ken Lambert's place down there. He had moved there about 2 years ago when that place was starting to come back after Hurricane Katrina, and a lot of people were coming down there to start playing poker again, and he was kind of taking advantage of that market. He says, you know what, that's gotten a little tougher now. Yeah. So he sees Florida as a soft market, and that's his new home after 2 years in Biloxi. And I don't think he's going to be alone, and I don't think that market's going to dry up for quite a while because there's a lot of money floating around in South Florida.
Well, not only that, but it still is going to be a tourist attraction. It still is going to be new money coming in there. That's one of the things out in Vegas. There are the grinders. There are other people that play there, but there's every weekend new people that arrive there for whatever the highlights is they're going there.
Some of the local grinders there were telling me they can't wait for the snowbirds to get there.
There you go.
Starting around November. Maybe Thanksgiving, and then throughout the winter, all the people from up north who are going to come down there, and
there you go.
Maybe they've got a home down there, or they're visiting relatives or whatever, and they're going to want to play some poker.
Yep,
that's where it's
going
to be.
Martha, I'm going over to the casino. See you in $500.
So I had a good time down there in Florida, and that's my road report. Yours is a little bit more intense because you've just come back from 2 weeks on the international poker front, and let's start where you went first, where we talked to you on the show 2 weeks ago. From Rosario, Argentina, at the Latin American Poker Tour. How did that turn out for you?
It was phenomenal down there. We had no idea. I did a couple of tweets about getting there and the problem we had with the protesters on the road, and it took us 30 hours to get to this place.
Yep.
But I had no idea. I'm not familiar enough with Latin America and South America. Rosario had over 1 million people in that town. It is the second largest city there, second or third largest in Argentina. It's a huge place. Some of the sites they had there were phenomenal. We got a chance to do that. We ran into a couple of people, became friends with them. They took us out on their boat. We went through the canals. We pulled up to a restaurant / bar, whatever, and had a meal there that night. I mean, it was a great time. They treated us like gold. PokerStars does an excellent job of this. When you come in there, you know you're taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
They give you the little bag. They greet you. They will treat you, you know, and make sure that you have a good time when you're down there.
Mm-hmm.
So, never been to Rosario before. Don't know if I'll be back there again, but I had a good time on it. I just wish I'd have played longer in the tournament.
Yeah, how long did you last in the main event?
I missed the money by, I believe it was 10 people.
Oh.
Yeah. But short stacked the entire time,
literally.
Not catching hands. I was having to buy pots and do this and that and anything I can to survive type stuff.
Yeah.
The last three hands that I tried to get involved with, the first two I got away with, the third one I just couldn't. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. I had an ace queen, and I ran into aces, and I showed the guy my hand, and he showed me his, and I went, okay, no problem. I had ace jack, a gentleman raised that I'd played with before. I re-raised him. This guy shoved, who was the tightest player on the table, came around. The first guy called him. I'm going, I am so far gone on this, and I threw my I threw the ace queen away on that one.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy that called had the ace jack. The other guy had kings. So both of those cost me a lot of chips. I'm crippled. In big trouble.
Yeah.
Comes around to me. I look down at it. I think it was an ace three of spades. I've got four people to act behind me. Four people ahead of me have folded. I have eight big blinds.
Mm.
Guess what?
It's all going in.
It's in there, baby.
Any ace.
Any ace. And I'm hoping that, you know, I don't get a call. And if I do get a call, my ace is going to be at least good.
Yeah.
And the guy looks at me and goes, sorry, and holds up two aces.
Not good. Not good. You know when they put up your percentages on the TV shows?
Yeah.
On that one it says, forget it.
Yeah. Okay. I was figuring a negative sign in front of it or something. But that happens. I mean, it wasn't bad play against me. I just ran into some hands and everything, and I had a good time down there.
Did you get to play in any of the cash games there?
I did, but there wasn't much in the way of cash games down there. They're very small. They're still developing them down there. The tournaments themselves are getting rather good-sized, and they're getting a real good turnout. They had several other things that they got going there, and they're trying to branch them off and get some PLO tournaments and trying to get some a variety of other games that way and a variety of different limits. And they had a couple of lady events, and they're doing the whole thing. It's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to what they have going on the EPT now. I don't think people realize. Do you know what the biggest poker tour in the world is right now?
No.
The EPT.
Is that right?
If you figure it by volume of dollars for entries, for whatever you want to do it, for a complete thing, it beats everything else.
Wow.
And
now, they're not getting more entries than the World Series of Poker.
No, no. No.
I saw that the number of people who were in the main event of the EPT in London, which you played in, last year they had 730. This year, 848.
Correct.
So they broke a record there.
Another 120% increase, just like before. And now then they are playing Raz. They're playing Omaha 8 or better. They're playing there were three different ladies tournaments there.
Mm-hmm.
They literally would have three or four different ones going on every day up there. It was awesome. And when I left last night, I hate to admit this, when I left last night, there were heads up with John Jawanda.
Yep.
Who ended up winning that?
A guy named by the name of David Vamplew from Scotland defeated John Jawanda after 4 hours of heads-up play, this in the 5,000-pound main event.
Wow.
So Vamplew makes about $1.4 million U.S. dollars. He's now the most successful tournament poker player from Scotland. I can't name another one, can you?
No, I can't either.
But John Jawanda, this is interesting. John Jawanda made $860K U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
That moves him up to fifth place on the all-time tournament poker earnings list.
Yep.
He moved past Peter Eastgate. He moved past Joe Hashem, who also did well.
Yes, he
came in 15th in the EPT London. And he moved past Scotty Wynn. So John Jawanda now, $11.3 million in live tournament earnings. And here's a guy who's there and playing in all these big events, but you don't see very much because he doesn't get TV time. What's the last time you saw John Jawanda invited onto a TV show?
I know. I've actually had the question posed to me several times. What do you consider the best unknown professional or you know, whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And you can name a Michael Binger, and you can name several different people that don't get very much TV time, but you know are extremely good players.
Yeah.
John Jawanda just fits right in there.
Absolutely.
You do not want to sit down at a table with this guy.
I also want to give credit to a guy who you've talked about from the LAPT earlier this year.
Oh, yes.
Jose Nacho Barbera, who's from Argentina.
Yep.
Who won the 20,000-pound high roller event. Is he a Team PokerStars pro?
Yes, he is.
He defeated a guy from Finland named Johnny Santula, heads up, earning £556,000. This is the fourth PokerStars-sponsored tournament that Nacho Barbera has won this year.
Yes.
He went back-to-back at the LAPT main event and won in France in May, and now he wins this one.
Yes. He is on quite the roll.
So there's a guy, you know, you told us to watch out for this guy.
I absolutely did.
I think you met him last year when you were at one of the
events. I did. I met him actually in a satellite in Uruguay. And I was impressed with his play and was talking to him. That's before he won any of these tournaments.
Yeah.
And we became somewhat friends and we've kept communication up. And the guy has just gone nuts this year.
How did you do in the EPT?
Anyhow, I liked London.
Oh, you liked London. That means you got to do some sightseeing, which means you didn't do well in the tournament.
No,
I can read the cards.
Yeah. I had ace-king, flopped an ace. A guy flopped a set. Got away from it, but it cost me, you know, a lot of my chips.
Yep.
And then the old standard one, I have pocket kings, and guess what the other gentleman has?
Yeah, the aces.
Yeah. So that ended my tournament there fairly quickly.
Yeah.
But I did play some cash over at the Vic. Enjoyed it right there.
Mm-hmm.
And had a very good night. Would have had a great night, except for a guy catching a card on the river on me. But I still came up plus.
Yep.
And what was so amazing, bear with me for a minute. I got to tell you this one because his reaction was so amazing. I have pocket jacks. Make a preflop raise. This guy re-raises me, who's a fairly tight player. You know, I'm a little bit worried about it, but not that much.
Yep.
I smooth call him. Let's see a flop. Flop comes out there, 8 high with 3 hearts. This guy leads out. I'm going, I've got an overpair, but no heart. Do I want to get involved in this? I went ahead and smooth called that one. The turn is a jack.
Mm-hmm.
I now have top set.
Mm-hmm.
No hearts are out there. Now, the jack of hearts is not showing up, so there's 3 other ones.
Yep.
This guy checks. I bet the pot. He calls me instantly.
Not good.
Hmm. Actually, if he had a flush right there, he's raising me. When
really?
He just called me,
hmm.
I actually felt good.
Really?
I really did. I went, wow, this
okay.
is cool.
Well, I don't know the player. I don't know the
you
circumstances.
You don't, absolutely.
Yeah.
Against you or something, if you smooth call me when that jack comes out there, I'm scared to death, okay? Against this guy, I actually, because I was expecting him, I got to find out where I am. I put my bet out there. He just smooth called. I went, wow, this is great.
Yeah. Right.
Turn card is a 4th heart.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm dead.
Yeah.
He checks. I throw up my hands. I check. And he turns over a pair of tens with a 10 of hearts. Said, I had you the whole way. I couldn't resist it. I said, well, not quite.
Yeah.
And I turned over 1 jack, and he went, oh, you got lucky. And I turned over the 2nd jack, and he goes, oh, I got lucky.
Yeah. Nice.
But he's a good guy and everything. And, you know,
he called a pot-sized bet on the turn with
pocket tens and a heart, yes. So, with a 10 of hearts.
So he's drawn to a fifth nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, assuming the board doesn't pair.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was a very large pot that would have been nice to win.
All right. Yeah. Well, Annie Duke is going to join us here in a couple of minutes. Before she does, we've got to talk about some online poker news.
Okay.
First of all, the New York Times had a big story about it in the Sunday paper, big article about how some brick-and-mortar companies, like this one that we're sitting in now, mm-hmm. Harrah's, have come around to like the idea of legalized online poker and gambling. Harrah's, of course, already has the WSOP website up and running with people playing live poker on that in Europe,
correct.
But not here in the United States. They
correct.
Are ready to go to turn the switch
absolutely.
On as soon as it gets legalized here. But Barney Frank was quoted last week as saying that he is not optimistic about H.R. 2267 becoming law. It has not come to a vote on the House floor. As we've told you, there's no companion bill from Congressman Jim McDermott in the Ways and Means Committee. And Robert Menendez's bill in the Senate hasn't gone anywhere. So right now we'd have to wait until the lame duck session, and the chances of that don't seem great. But the other big news for online poker in the last few days is out of Washington State. And you know more about this than I do, where a judge in Washington State Court has ruled, correct me if I'm wrong here, Dennis, that poker is a game of luck, not a
correct.
Game of skill. Which goes counter to rulings that we've gotten out of other judges in other states.
Out of numerous other states, yes. In fact, this is the first time that a judge has really ruled that way on the appellate level. And it goes against a dozen other ones and a dozen other presidents. And it's going to be contested.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I don't agree with it. I think the gentleman is misinformed. I think he needs to be educated. We are going to continue to fight this to try to get it corrected and put back into its proper stance. But as of right now, that is his ruling.
Now, that's had an effect on PokerStars.
Absolutely.
Explain what they've done.
Well, what PokerStars does is they will abide by the rulings around there. They are an extremely ethical company. Do they agree with this? No. Will they fight this? Yes. Do they believe the guy is mistaken? Absolutely. But any time there is a clear-cut ruling like this, they are going to abide by it. That is their stance. It's been that way since the gentleman that founded this in 01 started it out, and that's the way he's going to follow it. I think we need to make sure that we educate the ones up there in Washington. The problem is now, though, and because of this ruling, what PokerStars has done is they are prohibiting anyone who has an IP port that's based out of Washington up there from playing on PokerStars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, any and all funds that are in there are available, obviously, to the players. What they can, and how they want to handle it will be up to each individual player. But while this ruling stands, PokerStars is going to basically not allow them to play on that
side.
So
if you've got a computer in Washington State and you try to log on to PokerStars, their software will now block you and you're not allowed to play from there?
That is correct.
Yeah. Have they had to do that anywhere else in the world that you know of?
There have been a couple of times where there were some hesitations because of the local ones. At the present time, though, we've had issues in Italy. We've had issues in France. We've had issues in Russia. All of those have been resolved, and PokerStars is back up, fully regulated, complying with all the laws. Everything is fine and dandy.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll end up that way in the U.S., and I think the gentleman from Washington will find out that he was mistaken in his rulings.
Mm-hmm.
But until that time comes, again, we will honor what the existing opinion is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very unfortunate for those players. And, you know, we just got to find a way, again, through the PPA, through whatever, to counter this and to get this get them educated better up there.
Well, our guest, Annie Duke, is going to join us here in a couple of minutes, did some testifying before Congress about online poker this
uh-huh.
summer. That's one of the things we're going to talk to her about when she joins us next here on The Final Table, which is brought to you by PokerStars and the Poker Players Alliance and Harrah's St. Louis, where we do the show every week and where this Sunday, when the calendar changes to 10-10-10, October 10th, they're going to do their biggest cash giveaway of the year, over $70,000 given away to over 70 winners in one day. Somebody's going to win $1,010 every 10 minutes. How do you get in on this? Anytime Sunday you come in and swipe your total rewards card starting at 10 a.m., you are in on the giveaways, which will go on every 10 minutes. $1,010 every 10 minutes from Harrah's St. Louis. To be part of it, just come down here on Sunday. Or come down any day and enter into the ongoing football contest where you swipe your total rewards card between noon and 8 and make your free weekly pick. And somebody wins $10,000 for the most correct picks during the football season. All that plus all of the poker action here in the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, which will once again come April be home to a World Series of Poker circuit event. For details, go to the website harrahsstlewis.com, harrahsstlewis.com, the home of the Final Table. On the website, thechipleader.com, you'll find our podcasts and our live shows every Tuesday at 3 on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. Welcome back to the Final Table, the weekly poker show with Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips. I am Paul Harris, and we're joined now by Annie Duke, who's had a pretty good 2010. Oh, I guess we're not joined by Annie. Mike's going to call her back and get her on the phone. Annie has had a pretty good 2010. She won the National Heads Up Championship in March, knocking out Dennis.
There you go.
Along the way. She came in 8th in the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions in June. She came in 19th in the LAPC Championship in February. She's also got a new app, the Annie Duke Poker Tutor for the iPhone, and is starting up her own new online weekly show as well. Annie Duke, welcome back to the Final Table.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing great. It's nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, actually, I was waiting for you to get on, and then my iPhone dropped the call, so I just had to quick dial back in. So.
Well, I'm
speaking of iPhones.
Yeah. Well, before the break, you may have heard we were talking a little bit about some of the changes in online poker and the law, and we know that you testified this summer before Congress, and by the way, we praised you up and down here. I even emailed you about it, and I thought you did a fantastic job.
Thank you.
Tell me what you think is going to happen going forward. Give us a little prediction.
Well, I think that, you know, I think at this point it's not really a question of whether the law is going to change. It's more a question of when and what that's going to look like. So, you know, what I've been hearing is that probably about 50-50, maybe a slight favorite, that something will happen in the lame duck session. Interestingly enough, it's probably more likely to happen if the Democrats get slaughtered, although that isn't really a good result in the long run for online gaming. And the reason why is that if the Democrats get slaughtered, then they're going to sort of give a big, you know, F you on this on their way out, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
But, you know, that's not a good result, because then if something doesn't happen in lame duck session, then you have a very Republican-controlled Congress, and the Republicans haven't necessarily been the friendlier party to the legislation. But I think that everybody agrees that it's going to happen. I mean, you know, it's definitely regulated in lots of other countries that are our allies. I think America's waking up to the fact that losing the tax revenue is ridiculous. So, you know, what I'm hearing is anywhere from November in the lame duck session to 2 years is when it will pass, and then it would be a matter of when they actually get a regulatory body in place. So I don't want people to be under the misimpression that if it passes on in November, that it's legal in November. If it passes in November, they still have to put a regulatory body in place. And to give you an idea, UIDEA passed in 06. There weren't regulations published until 2010. So the bureaucracy can take a while, but obviously it will change the environment to much friendlier. I think the bigger question is what's going to happen with the operators that are facing North America now, and under the new regulatory system, are they going to be able to operate? And I think that's the big question mark.
Well, that's one of the major issues that's going to be is even if it's passed, in what form is it going to be passed, and
right.
Who gets to interpret it, and I mean, there's a variety of things. How many licenses are going to be awarded? How are they going to award them? How are they going to be regulated? Is it going to have to be a brick and mortar? Is it going to have to be an established clientele? Is it going to? I mean, we could go on and on on that. Do you have one or two key points that you would like to see in this legislation, or that you would not like to see in it, the way with some of the amendments they have right now?
Well, you know, I actually think that the amendments are pretty good. I think the most interesting amendments are looking at the Sherman Amendment and the Backman Amendment. So, and the reason why is because those conflict with each other. So Spencer Bacchus has been really a very violent opponent of the legislation. In fact, 2 years ago, a similar piece of legislation was brought up in financial services. It looked like it was going to pass, and Bacchus kind of did this last-minute burning up of political currency to swing like 9 Republican votes and create a stalemate. So it actually ended up being a tie, and it didn't pass out of committee. So this is someone who's been very anti. So he has an amendment with Backman, which says if you have been breaking the law since 2006, then you cannot obtain a license in the U.S. Now, what's really interesting about that is it's a very odd amendment because it basically doesn't say anything about before 2006. So if you take somebody like Party Poker, for example, who has very clearly stipulated that they were breaking the law before 2006, they stipulated that with the DOJ and have made a settlement, you know, I guess that they're okay. But, you know, he's obviously sort of directing at, you know, Tilt and Stars and UB there. Now, the Sherman Amendment says that you have to certify with the regulatory body that you haven't been offering any illegal games. So that's actually the broader amendment. When it comes to reconciliation, probably the Sherman Amendment is the one that's going to win out there because it's not setting a timeline on when you were doing illegal activity. It basically says if you've ever been doing illegal activity. So it's a better amendment. Now, what's interesting about that is that the online operators very clearly believe that they're not offering illegal games in the U.S. UIGA only applies to banking laws and transfer of funds. It doesn't apply to the games. And, you know, it's definitely the opinion of the North American-facing operators that poker is a game of skill. It doesn't fall under the Wire Act of 1961 and that they've never been offering illegal games. Now, I happen to agree with them, but that doesn't mean the regulators will agree with them because there may be political pressure on them to not allow them to operate. And I will say this, that when I was in the hearing, it was extremely aggravating because basically every single representative was just referred to the people as the illegal operators, the illegal operators over and over again. And, of course, you know, they're not illegal operators, at least not in their opinion, and they have very strong legal opinions that say they're not illegal operators. Lots of people agree with them, and they're licensed in many jurisdictions, including many allies of the U.S. So it's a little frustrating that that's the prevailing opinion, but that prevailing opinion, I believe, may be what stops them from being able to be licensed at least under the brand names that they're operating under now.
Certainly none of the online operators from PokerStars, which Dennis is affiliated with, to Ultimate Bet, which you're associated with, to Full Tilt Poker, to Doyle's Room, none of them has ever been convicted of a crime. None of them has ever been prosecuted for a crime. To my knowledge, none of them has ever been indicted for a crime of putting poker online. As you point out, the UIGEA doesn't restrict the ability of Americans to play poker. It restricts the banks and the movement of money, right?
Right. So, you know, I think that people are under the impression in the Party Poker case that the reason why they settled with the DOJ was because they were offering games. And that's actually not true. They violated banking laws. So basically that had to do with miscoding transactions. So every transaction that you make, particularly with a credit card, is coded so that people know what kind of transaction it is, whether it's retail or gaming or whatever it might be. You know, there was a lot of difficulties with processing transactions that were coded to gaming, and so they basically figured out a way to get around that, which is really violating law, and that's what they were settling with the DOJ about. They weren't settling for offering games, and I don't think that people really understand that. I think that they thought that, I think if you asked the average person what was that case with Party Poker about, they would say, well, they were illegally offering gaming in the U.S., and that's actually not what it was about. The issue is that the UIGA very clearly did not update any existing laws. And the reason why they didn't update any existing laws is because UIGA is a federal law and gaming is handled at a state level. And we know that this country was founded as a republic where the states have rights and the federal government is extremely loath to step on the rights of the states. So essentially you have this thing called the Wire Act. And the Wire Act states that you can't bet sports wagers across state lines. So we know that anybody offering sports betting is definitely breaking the law. other than that, it's handled state by state, and it absolutely depends on what state you're in. In a state like Utah and Hawaii, for example, it's extremely clear that gambling isn't allowed. They don't even have a state lottery. In a state like Washington, they have asserted that it's an offense that's worse than getting caught for drunk driving, by the way. I think you can go on your fifth DUI and still not get the same penalty as wagering $10 online in Washington State. But Whatever, they have a state law that says that you cannot play poker online. So we know that it's illegal there. In my home state of New Hampshire, however, it's completely legal to play. And that's basically, when you look across the states, it looks like it's probably about 38 states where it's definitely legal, and then there's some states with gray areas. And then basically there's Washington State, Utah, and Hawaii, where it's very clear. And so the fact is that UIDEA doesn't say anything about gaming being illegal. It didn't update any statute. There is no statute that it updates. The prevailing law is still from the early 1960s with the Wire Act, and that's the prevailing law you have to go with, which just says if you're not offering sports betting, you're probably fine.
You know, now would be a good time for me to mention that our show is brought to you by the Poker Players Alliance. they're the ones who helped Annie.
Educated me.
Yeah, know all about this and helped her out with her testimony on Capitol Hill. If you're not a member of the PPA, right now, while you're sitting and listening to this podcast on your computer, go to thepPA.org, thepPA.org. You can become a premium member for $20, less than the buy-in to many tournaments, or certainly more than you're going to put on the table for less than you're going to put on the table for a cash game. Become a member, as we all are, and support this group that fights for all of us at the federal, state, and local levels, and in courthouses around the country as well. The Poker Players Alliance.
Yeah, Annie, you bring up so many good points there. I don't even know where to start, because you're exactly right in what the law in 06 actually did, which was not much of anything. It dealt basically with the banking, with the individual states. Then, and you said Utah and Washington and Hawaii, the three exceptions to it. Which
and Spencer Baucus' state of Alabama doesn't have a lottery either, by the way.
Oh well, okay.
Well, there you go. Well, I guess I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
But the thing of it is, this is going to be here in effect. It is in effect in all these other countries around the world. I have watched it be developed in France and in Italy, where PokerStars and the other companies came in there. They said, we want to be regulated. Let's put together something that's fair for everybody. And then they've complied with all of the laws. They're doing it in Estonia now. It looks like...
I'm sorry, we lost her. Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, but it looks like in Denmark and in Belgium and in the Netherlands, it's also going to be happening here. It's going to be happening in the U.S. Let's put this thing together. Let's make it a fair play for everybody. Let's make it an equal playing field for all of the companies, and let's just go forward.
Absolutely.
It's a great place to be taxed. It's a great place to be set up, the whole bit.
Yep.
I just don't understand what all these hesitations are on it.
Yep.
And
well,
when you get
I can answer that. The hesitation really comes from the fact that the people pushing it forward were – putting forward the cause of the moral majority. If you look at the three people who were really the engine behind UIDEA, it was Bill Frist, who believes the world is 6,000 years old, Good Lat, who believes the same, and Spencer Baucus. And you have Bible thumpers who believe that they're supposed to be legislating morality. So because they believe that gambling is an immoral act, it's going to destroy the fabric, the moral fabric of the U.S., they feel that it's the government's job to regulate it. And, you know, obviously, I find that completely appalling. It's definitely anti to anything that this country was founded on. We ran away from a country that was trying to tell us how we could worship. So, you know, and that's really where it comes from, because from any logical standpoint, from a revenue standpoint, from a civil libertarian standpoint, and more importantly, from the people yelling and pounding their chests about keeping minors off the internet and consumer protection, the current status is completely ridiculous. While certainly UB, Tilt, and Stars are doing best practices in order to keep problem gamblers off and keep children off, they're not required to. And there are certainly operators who are not using best practices to do that. So all these people saying, oh, well, if we regulate online gaming, we're going to have all these children gambling on the internet. What's stopping them now? The UIDEA doesn't regulate minors. It doesn't regulate any consumer protection laws. It regulates banks, period. So if you're really interested in the best interest of consumers and the best interest of children, you need to regulate it so that online companies have to comply with best practices to keep minors offline and problem gamblers offline.
Great points. Annie Duke, our guest here at the final table with Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris on 590 The Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcasts on thechipleader.com. Dennis is just back from an overseas trip to Argentina first and then to London, where he played in the EPT, and it seemed like the entire poker world was in London at some point in the last month, because not only was the EPT there, but the World Series of Poker Europe was played there. You didn't make the trip,
and
did you?
WPT. I couldn't make the trip. This is I have to tell you, in the irony of ironies, I have a deal with Harrah's this year for 3 appearances. So I had done my first appearance last spring before the WSOP, and they scheduled my second appearance during the final event of the WSOPE. And I called them up, and I was like, dude, it's all Harrah's. Like, I can't go to the WSOPE now. And they said, well, this is the only weekend we can do it. And so I was in Harrah's Atlantic City fulfilling a contractual obligation.
Oh,
and
gosh,
that's why I couldn't go to the WSOPE Harrah's. I have to tell you, like, I'm completely on tilt about it. Thank you for bringing it up.
Well, you know what? Let me put you a little bit more on tilt. Let's talk about this a little bit more, because I was curious about this, and I was playing this weekend and got into a debate with some guys at a regular cash game here. None of us has ever played in any of these main events. We're all cash game players, not tournament players.
Right.
But we started talking about the WSOPE bracelets. You know, Gus Hansen just won his first one. Phil mm-hmm. Locke just won his first one. John Jawanda just missed out on one in the EPT yesterday. But at WSOPE, they give out bracelets that are equivalent to the Las Vegas World Series of Poker bracelets. And I'm wondering, as the owner of a WSOP bracelet yourself in Omaha 8 back in 2004, do you think that when they win one in London, it should be equivalent to the one that you won in Las Vegas?
You know, I think that that's up for the consumers to decide. I mean, we know that not all bracelets are the same, right? Because when you hear people talk about the women's events or the seniors' events or the employees' events, nobody actually thinks that's a bracelet. So I think that if you ask most people, you know, if somebody just has a ladies' bracelet or somebody only has the seniors' bracelet, I don't really think that people consider them to be a bracelet holder in the same sense, because those events aren't open. Right. So the consumers have sort of spoken about that. They put a big asterisk on the closed events.
But if,
so, you know, honestly, I think it's up to the consumers to decide. I mean, I think that from sort of the consumer standpoint, from the poker playing standpoint, there's already a difference between what people think about bracelets that were won 10 years ago versus what they think about them now, because, you know, there used to be 20 bracelets awarded and now there's 55. So, you know, I think that that's a little bit of dilution. And people say, yeah, but now you have to beat 3,000 people to get a bracelet. And that's true, except there's 55 of them given out. And I think that that just makes them just that a little bit less special. And I'm not saying that the World Series of Poker bracelet isn't super special. Obviously, it is. Everybody's trying to get one. I'm just saying that I think that people give a little bit more weight to bracelets that were won back when there were fewer given out. You know, so I think it's up to people to decide. As far as I can tell, just sort of putting my finger in the wind, people don't view the WSOP bracelets the same as they view the ones in Las Vegas right now. But, you know, I think we'll see down the future. I mean, the fact that you have people like Gus Hansen, John Jawanda,
Phil Locke,
those caliber of players winning bracelets there suggest to me that they should be highly valued, because you really are getting the best of the best who are picking up those bracelets, and those are people who really deserve to be getting bracelets and should be, you know, and you would expect them to win a bracelet in Las Vegas. So, you know, from that point, I think they're very valuable. I just think that the brand hasn't caught up to it, so the consumer doesn't value them in the same way.
Dennis,
I know there was the big fight between, which was awesome to watch, by the way, between Matt Savage and Ty Stewart on Wicked Chops Poker. But
yeah, Matt says he doesn't like it. He doesn't think it's a real bracelet. Dennis, if Phil Ivey had won a bracelet at the WSOPE, could we count that as bracelet number 9 for him? Or would it be 8 American, 1 European?
Actually, I do think you can. My opinion is a little bit different from Annie's, similar to it, but a little bit different, because I talked to several players. I played in Argentina. I did not play the WSOP Europe this year, but I talked to several people. I talked to a Tommy Vitas. I talked to several of them. They said that was one of the toughest tournaments they'd ever been in, because the caliber of players was so high. All of the pros were over there. Every table you sat at, you could recognize two or three different people that you'd seen on TV that had bracelets, had some sort of, you know, recognizability there. And he said it was one of the toughest terms he ever played in. To win that tournament, to me, is a major achievement. And again, you're talking about Phil Locke and the rest of them.
I have an interesting perspective to bring on this because I'm sort of privy to a lot of bracelet bets that are going on. And what's very interesting, and I think that this is telling about where consumers view those bracelets as of right now, is that those are only used for pushes. So as of right now, if you have some sort of bet where, like, you have to win two bracelets in a World Series, usually they put in a stipulation where if you win one in Las Vegas and one in Europe, it's a push opposed to a win. And that's the way most of those bracelet bets are designed at the moment.
So I think
that sort of brings a unique perspective on it.
So if Durr had won one in Europe, everybody wouldn't have had to pay him off on the bracelet bet?
You know, I don't know what Durr's exact bet is. I know what a lot of the Ivy bets look like.
Yes.
I think that the Durr bets are similar, but I don't know for sure. But I know that there's a lot of stipulations being put in on the Europe bracelets where they're not necessarily being counted all the way toward a win, which I think is kind of interesting. That may change.
Yeah.
But that's definitely the status at the moment.
Yeah. When Howard Lederer was on the show, he explained the same thing and about the detail and how that would be the push with the bet that he has with Ivy.
There would be my inside information.
There you go. I could tell where that was coming from.
I've got some inside access there.
Yeah, you have a good connection there, I think.
I do, yeah.
So, Annie, now that we've talked about Gus winning a bracelet over there and Phil Locke winning one over there, who do you think deserves to win one who's never won one? I mean, I'm not talking about some...
Yeah, I know. Those are two big ones to cross off a list. You know, Phil Locke had come really close a couple years ago and then come in second. I think he came in second to Tan, if I recall. But, you know, he's come close a couple of times. Gus, on the other hand, is really interesting because I don't know that I would say that Gus deserved a bracelet only for the reason that he hardly plays the WSOP. He's never tried. Right. If there were a Gus who was trying and playing a lot of WSOP events, I would have put him at the top of my list of guys who clearly should have a bracelet but don't. Because, you know, obviously he's a great player. He's a and he definitely deserves it. It's sort of like that old joke, you know, I don't know if you've heard it, but the guy's praying to win the lottery and he prays every day and he never wins the lottery. And finally, after like a year, he's like, God, why have you forsaken me? I still haven't won the lottery. And he hears a voice come down from above. It would help if you bought a ticket.
Yeah.
So I sort of feel like that was kind of Gus. It would help if he actually.
Yep. I agree.
Yeah. But for a long time, you know, it was Eric Lindgren and then he popped it off. Interestingly enough, for a long time, it was me. And then I won a bracelet, and then it was DeWanda, and then he won a bracelet, and then it was Lindgren, and then he won a bracelet. Now, of course, Gus and Phil Locke have won a bracelet. I think the next in line is Durr. You know, I think that as Durr, you know, Durr right now has about $1.5 million in tournament earnings. He's never really put a lot of focus on tournaments.
Yep.
And now he's just starting to. He obviously had the second, which sent everybody, you know, into some nail-biting frenzy at the WSOP this year. You know, so he's definitely sort of dedicating himself to the tournament concept. I'm sure that he's working his way through the differences between cash game and tournament play and where you're supposed to slow it down and where you're supposed to speed it up and all the nuances that are different between the two media. You know, and I would say that he would be the big name that I would expect to see popping off a bracelet pretty soon. I mean, he's certainly going to be trying. He's a very smart kid. He's obviously an extremely good player, and you know, I have every confidence that he'll navigate his way through the differences between the two styles of play.
Well, I also think, if I remember right, because I think I was sitting at the same table when a bet between Durr and Phil Ivey about winning bracelets, so he has a lot of incentive to win it. Also,
he has a tremendous amount of incentive. If he wins a bracelet, you know, the word on the street is high seven figures and perhaps eight figures.
I have no idea what the total amount is, but it's huge. I know that.
I'll tell you a guy who would be on my bracelet watch list and has been for years, Andy Block.
Andy is so wonderful, by the way. He's such a great name to bring up. He has, I think, like over $4 million in tournament winnings. He's never won a WVT, and he's never won a WSOP.
Yeah.
Strong performance. So, yeah, he's definitely someone who I would – he's just such a dear friend of mine, and I would definitely
get
for bracelet. I'm pretty high on my.
Yep.
I agree with that. I've met
I'm
Andy
most.
Every time I see Andy, it's usually across the table at a charity event. That guy's an awesome guy. He really is.
Speaking of charity events, Annie, let's get a plug in for this event that you're doing for Child Rescue in a few weeks at the bike out in California. Tell us about that.
Well, I've got a few things coming up on tomorrow, actually. I'm flying to Chicago to host an event with Phil Hellmuth for Teaching Tolerance, which is something that's being Pritzker Foundation, which is obviously a wonderful cause. Then November 3rd, my brother and I, along with Sumner, okay, I just lost his name.
Redstone.
No,
Sumner.
Thank
Redstone.
Sumner Redstone. Are hosting an event at the bike on November 3rd for Child Rescue. In February, I'm hosting an event with Peter Facinelli from Twilight. We're hosting an event for the 1736 Family Crisis Center, and I hosted an event for them last year. I was very honored to be able to do that, and that's an amazing organization that supports families and children who are, you know, victims of abuse and you know, need help. And, you know, their locations are secret, so nobody can find them. I've never actually done a site visit because you're not really allowed to know where things are, which is excellent. And you can find out through them if you go to their website. So if you just search 1736 Family Crisis Center, their website will come up and you find out what they're doing. So I'm really, you know, I've been doing a lot of stuff sort of in, you know, education, child empowerment stuff recently. It's a cause that's really important to me. So I'm really honored to be asked to host those kinds of events.
That's great. Annie, we appreciate your time today. Before we let you go, oh, there she goes. We're having trouble with her iPhone.
Absolutely.
So you know what? We'll just say goodbye to Annie because I just wanted to say, you know, we appreciate the work that you do on behalf of poker players all over the place. And her website is annieduke.com. And I got a couple of emails from people after we promoted that Annie would be on the show this week asking me if I would bring up this subject. And it probably is a sore subject, Annie. If you don't want to talk about it, we don't have to. But I think I'm going to make a prop bet with some of my friends on exactly how long it's going to be before you and Daniel Negreanu make up.
Well, I'm only going to say one thing about that. Make up is really odd because in order for there to be a fight, it has to go two ways. So I don't really want to say much more about it except to say that I don't feel like attacking anybody publicly or airing grievances publicly is necessarily the way that I want to conduct my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I have only complimentary things about Daniel in terms of his play. I think that he's a great player. I think he's extremely good for the game. I think he's a great promoter of the game. And I have a lot of professional respect for him. And I don't think that there's any need ever to comment publicly about somebody personally, and I've never done that about him. The letter that I wrote on my blog was specifically directed at PokerStars in trying to have PokerStars recognize that he was a representative of theirs, and what he said did reflect on them, and I just wanted some acknowledgement that his words had some reflection on them as a brand since he endorsed them and was a representative of them. But I said in that blog very clearly that Daniel can say whatever he wants. He's an adult. He has a forum to say it, and it's his right to speak his own words. This is a country that has free speech, and he can choose whatever words he wants to express himself toward me, and that's his business, you know. So I personally don't think that commenting on your personal feelings, you know, in public is the way that I personally want to conduct my life.
Okay. Well, let's leave it at that. And by the way, have you and Dennis made up after you pounded him in the Heads Up Championship earlier this year? I guess you have, since you're on the show today.
I'm still trying to just get over the air horns. It was really funny, Dennis. So I'll actually tell you, this morning, Joe asked me, my boyfriend said to me, "What are you doing today?" At 1:20, I'm doing a radio thing. And he said, "Well, you know, it's Dennis Phillips' show." He goes, "Oh, are you bringing in an air horn?"
Yeah.
He said to me, "Eh."
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, though, that was my first time playing the Heads Up. Obviously, making it far enough along to be able to play against you was just a thrill. I just want a rematch in the finals.
Listen, I would love to have a rematch in the finals. I'll tell you what. That was, you know, that was a great tournament for me because I had not had a particularly good record in that event. From a combination of, there were a couple of times when I came in and I just wasn't very focused, and then there were a couple times when I just took, like, really horrific beats. So it was kind of a bad combo of me deserving to lose and me taking bad beats to lose, which is a lot of the way that poker goes, you know. So it was really nice to come in and just feel like I was just super-duper focused and really thought that I was making very good decisions. You know, when I got to the final with Eric, I got to tell you, he's so good. I just want to say that about Eric right now. He is so good, and I was so lucky to beat him because the kinds of things that he does to take away plays that might be working for you otherwise, he thinks so many level deep, and he's got so little fear, and he's so creative. You know, I tell people all the time, I just want to be Eric Seidel when I grow up.
Well, I'll tell you what, that was a complete turnaround for both you and Eric from what you've done in previous years, and it couldn't come to two better people. Final word, with everything you're doing with the charities and that, I just really, really respect the way you handle this, and I really appreciate the work you do for the poker players.
And we appreciate you coming back on the show, Annie. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, and hopefully you'll have me back again.
We absolutely will. Annie Duke, find her online at annieduke.com. Download her Annie Duke Poker Tutor app for your iPhone or your iPad by going to the iTunes store. Next week on the final table, Daniel Cates, Jungle Man 12, a guy who's been burning up the online poker world by taking on Durr in the Durr Challenge, and Isildur won in some of the highest stakes no-limit games of the year. We'll get inside that world next week with Daniel Cates. I'm Paul Harris. He's Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips. We're brought to you by PokerStars.net and the Poker Players Alliance and Harris St. Louis every Tuesday at 3 on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast available through the iTunes Store or on thechipleader.com. Thanks for listening.